On this week's 51%, we speak with artist Barbara Benesch about Art Mill, the art center she founded in Central Europe, and how she saw artists navigate censorship in former Czechoslovakia.
Art speaks through our intuition, through our feelings, through our heart, and those are things that are very abstract, so that's really hard to crack down on.
WAMC's Samantha Simmons also speaks with 10-year-old singer-songwriter Lulu Gray about their debut album. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh Alita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. There's been a lot of public discourse in recent weeks about the First Amendment and free speech, especially in the wake of the suspension of late-night host Jimmy Kimmel for his comments on President Trump and the MAGA movement's reaction to the assassination of Charlie Kirk. Now Disney and ABC have since returned Jimmy Kimmel Live to the airwaves, but lawmakers and viewers on both sides of the aisle decried the suspension as basically censorship of acquiescing to expectations of the Trump administration. Our main guest today has seen up close how censorship impacts creators and how art can still survive in authoritarian environments if there's a solid community around it. Barbara Benesch is an artist, writer, curator, and farmer from California, but much of her life and career has been in the Czech Republic, where she founded the international eco-arts center Art Mill in 2004. Today, the Czech Republic is a parliamentary republic, but for more than 40 years after World War II, the country, which was then Czechoslovakia, was under one-party totalitarian rule. Benesch says the communist government was very restrictive about what artists could and couldn't say in their work. She came to the country in the late 1980s, around the end of that regime and the start of the Velvet Revolution. Initially, she was just hoping to explore her roots, but Benesch says she ended up meeting a lot of Czech artists, and she saw how they continued to work and challenge the regime despite heavy censorship. Benesch helped to connect some of those artists with her American peers, creating the first dialogue between artists in both countries in decades. I recently spoke with Benesch about a new book she's written about that story and the creation of Art Mill, called Art Mill, A Story of Sustainable Creativity in Bohemia.
When I went over, when I was still very young, it was still during the totalitarian times. So it was under communist rule. It was very dark. I went over there ostensibly to find my family roots, but actually I was interested in how people were making art over there. I was a grad student in Los Angeles, California. I was exploring installation art, which was kind of taking art off the pedestal already after modernism. So art was kind of influenced by the feminist movement, by civil rights, by all kinds of things that were really challenging how art was being put out into the world. So that took me even further to go to Czechoslovakia. And I kind of fell in love with it when I was 19. But, you know, it was not possible for an American to live there then without giving up my passport. So I got involved with some of the artists. Long story short, created this exhibition, which was an exchange between LA and Czechoslovak artists at the time. And it was the first of its kind in over 50 years. So it kind of opened things up for me personally, for a lot of our friends. And I hope helped push the dial a little bit on the changes that came in 89. So I started this Eco Art Center there 20 years ago, and we have so many foreign visitors coming. We have students, we do study abroad, we've done programs with the EU. So we have a lot of people coming through, and everyone has always asked me, why are you here? How did you get here? You know, they've asked my story. So I thought I might as well just put it under two covers and I can just give them the book now. It's kind of an unusual story. So I hope it will inspire other women to not be afraid, especially in the times that are coming in the U.S. now, and especially young women, that, you know, the support we can get from each other is so vital now. And as an artist, it's hard enough to be an artist, but we're going to need that support, you know, more and more as we go into this next phase, whatever it's going to be.
What made you fall in love with the country exactly? What did you love about it?
So many things. So my grandparents were Czech. So the food is always, I think, a cultural connector for us, for all immigrants. So to have the firsthand food was amazing. The life there, of course, under the regime was brutal. I don't want to romanticize it in any way. Authoritarianism in any way or form is horrible. But because there was no capitalist system happening, it was slower. You know, everything was kind of compared to LA, especially. The life was slower. It was more connected to, it was more rural, connected to the earth. You know, industrialism came very late anyway in that part of the world. So that connection to the land was really strong. And I felt it even then. So that was one of the reasons. And the people were incredible.
You know, under that totalitarian regime, how did you see artists making art out there?
Yeah, so if you can imagine, there was no market, so no galleries. There were a couple museums, but they were all run by the state, so it was all very official art. It had to be, you know, approved by the state, which there's a lot of echoes happening in the US right now, ironically. We've had censorship in the US, but nothing like what's coming or what was there in Czechoslovakia and the former Soviet bloc countries. So a lot of artists who were doing contemporary art would do it at risk of, you know, getting interrogated, getting called in, or worse. So what they would do is they would have all these underground exhibitions out in the hops fields or in the courtyard, and they would organize each other, and it was all, of course, you know, clandestine. And that kept culture alive in what they've come to call now the parallel structures. So there were these, there was official structure, and then there was the underground structure. And when one of my trips over there, say from, to give you an example from LA, I get there and all my friends are listening to the new Tom Waits album that had just come out, which wasn't out yet in LA. And I was living, you know, coming from the culture where we had all this access to the arts, but actually the underground was really strong and they did too. So samizdat literature, you know, all these authors were publishing with each other in these kind of underground printing presses that I found fascinating, that it could survive and be so strong. So how did they do that? It was through community.
I'm wondering if there were, like, you know, were there specific things that the government was watching for, or things that artists couldn't say without scrutiny?
I mean, that's the beauty of art is that it can be abstract and it can work on levels that are not maybe particularly understood by a regime. They might not be as educated visually or historically in the arts, which could be a good thing. But I mean, you know, art speaks through ways that are not representative. You know, it speaks through our intuition, through our feelings, through our heart. And those are things that are very abstract. So that's really hard to crack down on. But say in the former Czechoslovakia, if an artist, you know, made an outward reference to a political figure, say that was, say, Jan Palach, who was a martyr who set himself on fire in 68, and he could not be referred at all to. So if an artist used fire, even sometimes the regime, the state would think that they were referring to that and they wouldn't allow it. So there are ways that can be very subtle visually that we can talk about things that they might get, they might not, you know. I mean, look at what's happening with the comedians, you know, on television right now. And I think comedy is an art form too. So there's ways we can make fun of them and keep them in their place without them even knowing it. And we need that.
Yeah, what you just said reminded me actually of a piece that we did a couple months ago now. We had a local artist on the show who also worked as an interpreter in the court system, and she ended up witnessing a lot of things in immigration court. And while she wasn't able to share details about the cases she was a part of, you know, she said she was still able to process what she saw in a more abstract way through her artwork, and she was still able to tell some of these stories without necessarily identifying anyone. So, you know, I agree. I agree that art can be a way to communicate things when words fail, or I guess when words are restricted.
Exactly. And it's not like what you said, even if she's not allowed to say the details, it's not what she's saying, it's how she's saying it or that she is saying it. And that's what happened in 1989 with that show we did. You know, we brought 12 artists over from LA and we showed with 12 Czech artists. It wasn't really about the sculpture or the paintings. I mean, that was good. The work wasn't bad. It was the fact that we came there in person and that had never happened before. We had 5,000 people come to the opening. People were renting buses from all over the country to come because it was the act itself that mattered. So what you're saying about this, to remember that these people are being incarcerated illegally, what's happening with ICE is the point. And that's an artwork right there, just the fact that it's getting out there. So that's the beauty of art is that, you know, we talk about social change or social action, that it makes an impact on the society in ways we don't even maybe understand. And it doesn't have to be that particular factoid, right? It's that it's
Absolutely.
happening. Yeah.
This might be a bit of a silly question, I don't know, but you mentioned that there are no markets or anything like that. So, I mean, was it possible for artists to get by as working artists?
Yeah, of course they were all working. They were poor by Western standards. But you know, if you look at the long shot, and again, I don't want to glorify it because it was not pretty, but they had some state support if they were not too outspoken, and that was always a fine line. And you know, everyone kind of helped each other. Everyone had a grandmother out in the countryside who grew food. Or they had a dacha out in the countryside where they could, you know, have a little vegetable garden. So there were ways of trading and mutual support and community that people stayed alive and I wouldn't say thrived, but were able to keep making art. And it you know, obviously was not the economy that was in the West, but because of that time slowness too. The obsolete of objects made them more precious and more treasured, if that makes sense.
Well, tell me a little bit about your work. What inspires the work that you create?
Well, I'm pretty broad-based. You know, a lot of my work comes out of being a female artist, so I've worked a lot with a female body. I did a whole, I was very inspired by the Venuses that come from that part of Central Europe, the ancient little figurines that we call the Venus of Willendorf, named after a man, ironically. But so these huge, you know, voluptuous figures of they perhaps fertility goddesses, we don't know. I did many series based on that. And, later on, as my work progressed and I moved out to the countryside from Prague, I was much more influenced by the land and the earth. So the ecology of the place has come to inform my work more and more, and connecting that to the female body. And then when I was working with the UN, I got involved in this thing called body burden, which is the amount of chemicals we all carry in our body now. So the latest installations were dealing with how our bodies are responding to that environment.
You started Art Mill in 2004. What kind of work is it doing now?
Actually, my eldest daughter is director now. She's running it with her younger sister. The next generation is taking it over. They just got back from Paris last night, driving back on this project we're doing with Table and Territory with a Creative Europe. We're open for residencies. We invite people from all over to come, propose exhibitions. We publish catalogs. We've got an organic farm working to feed people when they come. So yeah, we invite people to take a look at our website and reach out to us.
Well, Barbara, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today. I guess what do you hope readers most take away from your book?
Well, I hope it's inspiring. I mean, that's why I wrote it too, is to, you know, I see my daughters who are probably your age. We always say be strong, you know, but I think the lesson to take away is that community is so supportive, you know, be it your local community, even if you think you have nothing in common with them. We all do. We're all human beings, and that's what's going to get us through this. And you know, moving to a post-totalitarian country so soon after 89, you know, I saw how fearful people were to express themselves because they lived under this regime for 50 years, right? That relied on people being fearful. So they would not speak out because you would get in trouble or you would get interrogated or worse. So this fear mongering that this current regime's trying to, impose on Americans, I think is it's we cannot give in to that, and that the more support we have, amongst ourselves, that we've got to keep speaking out and keep making art and keep putting it out there and not be afraid.
Barbara Benesch is the founder of the Art Mill Center for Regenerative Arts in the Czech Republic and the author of Art Mill, a story of sustainable creativity in Bohemia. It's out now through New Village Press. You can learn more about Art Mill at artmill.eu. Closer to home, in Albany, New York, a local 10-year-old recently debuted their first album in front of an audience at Lark Hall. Lulu Gray started playing guitar 5 years ago during the COVID-19 pandemic, and they quickly got hooked. Already, they're no stranger to the stage. They've performed at the Capital Region Pride Parade and at Saratoga's historic venue, Cafe Lena. Gray's 7-song record, Dreaming in Gray, touches on the grieving process of fighting with friends and making sense of the world. Ahead of its release, Gray spoke with WAMC's Samantha Simmons and performed a few songs, starting with a track, Running Next to You.
As I was running down the road, I saw you.
Love to write songs, and it's a great way for me to really grieve and like process feelings, and it's fun to just sometimes like write. If I have an idea, I'll just go over to my guitar and start improvising.
Do you usually, I know you say improvising, but do you write lyrics or the melodies behind your songs first?
Usually I start playing chords on my guitar and then I'll just start singing, and usually my parents will record it and then we'll send it to my grandpa and he helps us type it out.
So when people listen to music and people feel a lot of emotions, and it could be a happy song that you are just absolutely sobbing at and maybe you don't know why you're sobbing at it, how do you bring your life experience to the table when writing for audiences of all ages?
Well, I have had a lot of loss in the past. And so when I write songs, grieving, like it helps me grieve. And it kind of releases like that tense feeling. And yeah, and it makes me feel better and lighter almost after writing it. And for one song, I actually wrote it for my sister because she's autistic and recently had a solo art show. And I was really proud and happy for her, and I was kind of writing the song based off like how much I love her, and that like even though she's different, she's like one of the coolest people I know still. And this song that I wrote, Look at Us Now, is about a fight that I got into with a friend, And that kind of, it just helped me feel less angry about it. When I wrote that song, getting to play it made it like almost a really angry and sad experience into like one of the greatest things in my life, which was really cool. And Life After the Party, I wrote based off not my life experiences, but sometimes when I'm writing music, I'll find that it's almost like I go into like a different person or a different perspective, and that's kind of how I write songs for songs like that.
After the party, we're looking like hell. I got lost in the suburbs, but remember how I felt. It's life after the party.
So you talked about Look at Us Now and how that came from a fight you had with a friend. You turned it into not only a song, but a music video. So can you tell us about the day of like, or the days putting that together and what it was like, you know, being with your friends and classmates to tape that video? You know, you guys are sitting under, you know, those giant parachutes that you would use in elementary school in the gym. I wish I was a kid again to experience that one more time.
Yeah, it was a really fun day. And everybody was like really good and really awesome, and a lot of different people from like the community helped us out, and like a principal helped us, let us use the school for a day to film in it, and it was an awesome day, and I had so much fun.
At the end of the video, your friends are chanting Lulu. That was very fun. You're trying to hide like an embarrassed laugh, it seems, at the end there. What did that feel like, that moment?
I just felt so happy in that moment. I was just so excited for the music video and so grateful that it could happen.
You learned how to play guitar early in the pandemic, and that was something that you shared with your grandfather. What is that time, you know, being spent with him, and you said that you send the songs to him so he can write them out. What does that mean to you to have him helping you do this?
Well, I'm so glad he taught me guitar, because, like, I don't think any of this would have happened if he hadn't taught me guitar. So I'm really thankful for that. And he's like a great person to work with, and he's really fun to hang out with. And he's always been like so supportive, which I'm so glad about.
Something I thought that was interesting while listening through the tracks earlier today was how different they all sound. So Look at Us Now, which we have talked about now, reminds me of like an old sounding Disney song. And I would hear it in like a Hannah Montana montage, whereas like Running Next to You has a bit of twang with a little bit of soft jazz in it. And He Taught Me Everything is a little bit more heartfelt. So did you keep that in mind when you were trying to, you know, work with the lyrics and work with the sound of how they were all going to sound together?
Not really. No. I don't write songs the same every time. Sometimes they'll just be like, I'll pick up my guitar, start to play, and then write a song. Sometimes I'll improv, and then the ones I feel attached to, which were those seven, they went to the album, and some I didn't really feel attached to, so I like kind of let them go and moved on from them.
And what was the actual like recording process of the album like? Did you go to a studio? Did you have like a home studio? What did that look like?
I went to how I kind of started to write down my songs. Actually was like getting them on paper and starting to play them again. I went to an open mic hosted by Erin Harkes, and she asked if I would play at Cafe Lena and play four original songs. So that's actually when I started playing and writing those four original songs, which are on the album. And then we started, after Cafe Lena, we like decided that we wanted to record them and try to make an album. And so we went to Dan DeKalb's house, who helped us record and mix the songs. And Aaron's band, Hark, did all the instruments.
Remember how we used to get so close? We vowed to be best friends and never stopped dreaming. Now you're off someone else, I'm left behind. Well, look at us now, we won't even look at each other. We pass in the halls. And look at us now, we haven't seen.
That was 10-year-old singer-songwriter Lulu Gray speaking with WAMC's Samantha Simmons. Gray's debut album, Dreaming in Gray, is out now on Spotify, Apple Music, and Bandcamp. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half. He was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool, no electricity. Hot rain on the concrete. Sweet bells in little girl dreams. They said, oh, take it.